good, good question.
All right, let's be bold, people.
Well, let's be bold, people. There you go. Well, I want to welcome you all back again. Thanks for all the members who are here and for those who are coming and for the public and the department people and the clients who are here today for this very important topic. Steve, Representative Mack, I think, would like to offer the minutes. You want to have any discussion about those, Representative Mack?
No, I'm good, Mr. Chair. I'll just move to move the minutes.
I think they're 9 minutes. So, Representative Mack moves the adoption of the darn nice minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, that's taken care of. Oh, no, yeah. You got some. In your packets, is this in all the packets? Interesting. Everybody got one of these things? Yesterday we had, a really good discussion of the Minnesota Family Assistance Programs, and members already got this as part of that little phone book worth of... okay, no, we're already doing it, thanks. Good to have crib notes. Anyway, so this is more information about what was done yesterday. And if you read that whole little deck of stuff that you received over Christmas, this was in there, but now you have your own bound copy to keep by your bedside and to study. The House Research Department does remarkable work, and this is another example of the kind of information they can have. If the public would like one, I know they're online, and if you want a hard copy, just ask Andy. He can get us anything. Andy is my CLA. Another item you have to this... I like giving you a little current events, if only to understand where we're at. This is there was a State of the Union address last night by President Obama, and Representative Congressman Ryan gave a response that my 12-year-old actually enjoyed, which is interesting, I thought was interesting and immaterial of your view of which of those presenters you would have preferred. It's really important for us all to recognize the state of affairs in Washington and to understand the points of view of those people who are bringing the budgets forward. And so there's a little commentary about that. And then there's this cartoon about the debt, which I understand today was released to be $1.5 trillion, a new land speed record for federal debt. And they interviewed a congressman from New York. I don't recall his name on one of the shows afterward. And he was not thinking that was a good thing. And I think he said a little more strongly than that about what about spending. And I think there's two dates. The resolution about funding goes through March 4th, I think, and the debt ceiling debate comes up in April. And so just to help us be in the world of what's real and what we can expect, I'm just putting that out there for words to the wise. So if anybody wants to have a equal time on the other side, I'm open to that. But I'm trying to work in the world of the real. That's that for today. So we have a lot of work to do today on continuing care and waiver services and disability services. And if those witnesses want to start coming down, I'm going to turn the gavel over to. We did that. Yeah, Representative Lomer is going to be conducting that. She's the lead person on this study group about the waivers and so on. I see Mr. Coleman's here, so I'll turn the gavel over to her, and we have the balance of the hour. Is that right for this topic? Yeah, so we'll be spending until 2:15 on this topic, and there's a lot to cover, and I think questions are welcome, and if it gets too tight, the chair will let you know about that. So Representative Lomer, the meeting is yours.
Thank you so much, Representative Abler, and welcome everyone. Welcome, Mr. Coleman. If you want to identify yourself for the tape. And
certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for inviting me to present today. I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. We've been asked to spend about an hour today to talk about continuing care administration and what we do and how we do it. A couple weeks ago, you heard from Bob Meyer, who is part of our staff, who talked about the long-term care budgets at a pretty high level and the funding streams, where the money comes from, and how it's dispensed. Today, we'll talk in more detail about the various programs that we have in our long-term care system. The Continuing Care Administration is responsible for administering state and federal funded long-term care services. These are services that are provided to older Minnesotans and people with disabilities who cannot live independently or who need assistance in their own homes or in a facility and need the help of a public program to obtain the help they need. When you hear the word long-term care services or the phrase, you probably think first of nursing facilities. Continuing care does administer the rates for 381 nursing facilities across the state, but in addition to nursing facilities, we also administer services provided to people in their own homes. About 70% of the funding that we administer pays for services provided in people's own homes or in community-based settings. Waivers, which we use generically, are medical assistance services that are provided in people's homes or in small group settings rather than in a facility or an institution. And they're available for people who are at risk of going into a facility like a nursing home or a intermediate care facility for the developmentally individuals. So they are a type of home and community-based services, but waivers are not the complete home and community-based service system. The shift to serving people in the least restrictive environment was deliberate. It was a purposeful discussion and decision, and all surveys show that people would prefer to live in their own homes and in communities as long as possible, and doing so is most affordable for the state than serving everyone in a facility or an institution. It makes it easier when we serve people in their own homes to leverage the informal help of families and community to help people remain independent so that the state doesn't have to pay for all services that a person may need. But for those people whose needs cannot be met in their own homes, Minnesota offers residential care like nursing homes for people with the greatest needs. Those needing short-term rehabilitation, subacute care, memory care are also served in those types of congregate settings. In total, continuing care administers about $3.3 billion per year in state, federal, and special revenue funds to pay for long-term care services. So these programs are big, and they serve a lot of people. We've got challenges ahead of us. We've talked previously about those challenges. Let me mention a couple of them. The first challenge is to manage these public programs in a way that is equitable for program recipients and make them sustainable into the future. In your packet is a handout, and some of you have seen this type of presentation before, which shows both in graphic and in written form kind of the trends, the growth in our programs for the elderly and people with disabilities. For the most part, our programs for older Minnesotans are forecasted to grow at a rate of about 5% per year, a little bit under that. But we all know that looking out into the future with the baby boom generation, the age wave that is coming at us, that there will be increasing caseload pressure on our public programs to meet people's needs. On the disability side, and we've structured it so one is distinct from the other, spending is projected to increase at an annual rate of about 8%. These are projected increases mainly on the basis of increased caseload over the next number of years. To control, to manage, to make some decisions about the growth in these programs, we have proposed, and the governors and legislators in the past have made some decisions along these lines. We've adopted legislation to tighten eligibility for certain public programs while still preserving the programs for those with the greatest needs. We've adopted waiver limits that control how many new people can access the waiver programs. And we've adopted a moratorium around the use of the more expensive corporate foster care settings while encouraging the marketplace to develop less expensive service options. Some of these changes could be implemented right away, and we've been doing so. Some of them will not be effective until 2014 due to federal maintenance of effort requirements. Managing the programs are tricky, and these decisions are not easy. We want people to get the help they need as affordably as possible while ensuring their health and safety. At the same time, we must manage the growth carefully in a way that does not push people into the more expensive services like hospitals or nursing facilities or facility-based mental health services. And we don't want the state to supplant the help from families and friends and neighbors. In fact, we want to encourage the continued participation of families and communities. So you'll hear a bit later about a major goal of ours of supporting caregivers of all ages in all settings, supporting families, et cetera. But that's the challenge that we all collectively face. Lawmakers, stakeholders, program administrators, is to find that balance where people can get what help they need in the most affordable manner that still provides for the health, safety, and quality of care, quality of life. That's our immediate challenge, and I think something that's going to be with us for a long time. The second major challenge that we have is improving how we administer the long-term care services in Minnesota. Medical assistance program funding, state, federal grants, these are resources that we try to leverage to meet people's long-term care needs. But federal funding comes with mandates for assuring certain levels of service quality, record-keeping requirements, rules for eligibility and benefit levels, and there are also laws at the state level that make the service delivery system more complicated. All well-intended, but it makes the administration of the services that much more challenging. It's no secret that our service system in the long-term care arena is complex. Processes could be simplified so that the service delivery system is as simple and effective as possible. And that has also been one of our goals in administering the continuing care programs. So to give you a couple examples of how we're trying to do that, we have several projects that are attempting to make things simpler for providers, consumers, administrators, etc. One is the recipient assessment for services. You've heard about the project formerly known as Compass, now it's called MinChoices, which is to have a consistent process of assessing an individual's needs across all of our programs. And we can provide more details on that, but it really is collapsing four distinct assessment processes into one web-based tool that lead agencies, counties, health plans, tribes can administer most effectively. Provider contracting and enrollment. It is complicated for some providers to navigate the government rules and regulations. We are shifting some of that activity that had been taking place at the county level, and we're centralizing it at the state level in a better organized way so that providers don't have to go through it 87 times if they're doing business in 87 counties. So we're assuming that responsibility to enroll providers. You'll hear the term PEPSI, Provider Enrollment and Standards. That's our project name. Home and community-based provider rate-setting methodologies. The federal government has asked us to be more clear about how we determine rates for our different providers. So we are methodically going through each service sector, coming up with a methodology that is based upon the individual program participant's needs rather than setting a single rate for each provider who's out there. But the methodology is consistent regardless of where you are in the state. But there's more to do, and we'll continue to work at making the system easier to navigate where we can. Looking long-term, the third challenge that we face is the aging of the baby boom generation and the risk to the state if we don't prepare for that aging wave that's coming at us. Public programs are an important part of the solution, but they are not the only solution. Kind of where we deviate a little bit. We don't solely focus upon people who are enrolled in public programs when we talk about this particular phase of the work that we do. Because we're really talking about all people who are aging who have the potential to need public support, and how can we manage differently and help them along that way. We've got an opportunity over the next 10 to 15 years. We're kind of in a bit of a bubble where the high needs of the baby boom generation aren't here yet. Between the ages of 60 to 75, 65 to 80, whatever you want to peg it, those are not the highest consuming long-term care needs of the population. Even though we've celebrated 2010, and now we're into 2011, where the boomers are experiencing the first wave of turning 65, there still is this kind of lull for long-term care services. And so we've got some amount of time, but that time is shrinking. There's a ongoing dialogue across the state on this issue, and we've had multiple forums. Some of you have seen our Transform 2010 work, where we're trying to help communities and individuals and organizations prepare for this permanent shift in the demographics of our communities and our neighborhoods. I want to conclude my portion of the, because I was only allotted so much time for my portion. We're going to hear from the people who really manage the programs, our division directors, to let you know that I and our staff are always available to help you as you puzzle through these complex issues, these questions, these really important common interests that we have in maintaining a quality long-term care system, managing today, and planning for the future. We're going to move into some program overviews, and I know that's where you'll have some questions. But before I do that, let me make sure that you have some picture of continuing care staff. We have some documents that we've shared with you. One is business functions. We've organized a document that kind of tells you what we do and how we do it. We have approximately, although precisely at the moment, 247 staff within continuing care. Most are involved in managing the Medicaid long-term care programs, including the waivers, home care, nursing facility, rate setting type systems. We manage about 180 state and federal grant programs. We provide training, technical assistance, advocacy. For example, the Ombudsman for Older Minnesotans resides within continuing care, so there's some advocacy there. And we deliver direct services. You'll hear from deaf and hard of hearing that they're actually a direct deliverer of services within continuing care through regional offices throughout the state. The second handout that I will draw your attention to is a summary of our long-term care programs in Minnesota. And again, I encourage you to take a look at that at your leisure and familiarize yourself. There is a lot of material here, and it'll take more than one reading to digest it. And then another document that I want to draw your attention to is the question of maintenance of effort. And we've tried to identify for you some of the federal requirements that we have. It's a single document, what we have to demonstrate to the federal government, or we risk losing our federal participation. With that, if there's any general questions, I'd be happy to answer, or we'll move into some more specific program presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Any questions?
So far, so good. Okay,
thanks.
Very good. First, I'll call on Alex Bartolik, who is our Division Director of Disability Services.
Welcome, Ms. Bartolik, to our committee. Would you identify yourself for the record and then proceed?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik. I am the Director of Disability Services at the Department of Human Services. Disability Services manages those publicly funded programs that support people with disabilities of all ages. Many of these services are provided over the course of a lifetime because of the course of the or nature of the disability, although the type and arrangements will change as people go through different life stages. Lauren explained the handouts, and I'm going to let you look at the business functions to get more detail of the what we do. And I'd like to just highlight, however, some of the programs and the types of services that are provided to people. I'm not going to go into the same level of detail, but it is in the summary of long-term care programs and services that there's more information. People who need help at home often can use some of our MA home care services. So if they are on medical assistance, have some type of health care need or support need at home, so it's based on a functional assessment of their eligibility, they can tap into home care services, which might be home health aides, might be skilled nursing, personal care attendant or PCA services, which I know many of you have heard about, and private duty nursing. Now, these are state-planned services, meaning if you're on medical assistance and you have an assessed level of need for those services, you are able to access them. We do not have limits, or we're not allowed to place limits on the number of people that access those. We also manage policy and rates for intermediate care facilities for people with mental retardation, or the language we like to use is developmental disabilities, but we still have some federal language here, and also day training and habilitation services. These services can assist people, the ICFMR, where people can live and receive habilitative services. We have a little over 1,800 people currently using services in an ICFMR, which is a big difference. We used to have many thousands of people, including our state-operated regional treatment centers. We no longer have any people with developmental disabilities in state regional treatment centers. This was a deliberate policy move to convert services into home and community-based services, maintain ties with family and friends in their local communities. Day training and habilitation services offer a lot of activities, including habilitation and support to people during the day, but also increasingly employment so that people get support to find jobs and being able to work in the community. There are four waiver programs managed through disability services. Each of the programs serves a particular population, but many of the services are similar, and these all are assisting people to stay at home, live in their communities as an alternative to having to live perhaps in a nursing home, an ICFMR, or a hospital. So the programs through these waivers serve people with developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, people with complex health needs that otherwise would be in hospitals, and increasingly people with mental illness who need long-term services in addition to some of the therapeutic mental health services. Now, the waiver programs do have limits. So there, as Lauren had mentioned, some of the sustainability strategies in the past through legislation has been to place limits on how many new people can enter these programs, and that is allowable through the federal authority. We have several grant-funded programs that support people with developmental disabilities who don't need the level of care of a waiver or an ICFMR, but help them live independently at home in their community with some support services, and also that to provide support to families. We know that people have some additional support needs when they have a child living at home, and this gives them the flexibility to make arrangements for those supports. Other grant programs that we administer include the Disability Linkage Line. Now, this is a toll-free phone number that provides assistance. We actually contract with Centers for Independent Living, and that can assist people with questions they have related to disabilities. Through this, we also are able to provide support in helping people think about employment and understand the effect of employment on benefits, which is increasing the number of people who are able to work. We have additional grants out there. We have one grant contracted through ARC of Minnesota that's helping people move into their own homes where services can be tailored to just what they need and allow them to leave some more of the congregate settings if they choose not to, or to leave their family home and be able to live in their own home. We also have outreach activities to help people look at the use of technology as an alternative to some of the ways that people might otherwise help them to be a more cost-effective way to stay at home. We have 81 FTEs in disability services that manage state and federal programs that are paid for through the state dollars. But we also have two federal grants. They pay for an additional 32 people. One of these federal grants is the Ryan White Care Act. Now, this provides medication, insurance, and other services to support people with HIV/AIDS to live in the community, and this has been a very effective program at helping to manage an epidemic that is now allowing people to live with HIV/AIDS into their communities for a long time. We're in our last year of funding for the Pathways to Employment Grant, which is a Medicaid infrastructure grant, which is helping us change how our system interacts in order to increase the competitive employment of people with disabilities and to be able to work to meet the workforce needs of businesses in Minnesota. I want to offer a little bit of highlight of some of the reform efforts. Lauren mentioned a few, and there's some additional ones that are really changing our system, how we administer services, the ability of people to direct and manage their own services, and to streamline this so that we are able to achieve quality in a way that makes sense for most people. As he mentioned, we have a new assessment, this MIN Choices assessment, which will consolidate four assessments that will focus not just on people's needs and eligibility for programs, but what their strengths are and what their community has to offer, so that we are also able to target resources the best way possible. It will allow for that timely investigation of other support options beyond MA. And with better data, we are going to be developing individualized budgeting and able to make better policy decisions and provide information to you. PEPSI, which at some point we're not going to be able to use that acronym any longer, but really looking at how we can enhance provider standards, eliminate county contracts, and look at the monitoring component. We administer programs not directly by the state. We rely on counties and in some cases tribes and health plans to actually administer the programs. And this will simplify the process for providers, but it will also allow us to clarify the roles of what should the state do, what should counties do, what should tribes do, what should health plans do, as we work with providers to really assure that we're focusing on quality. A related activity that was also passed by the legislature is to develop quality outcome standards. We have different licensing standards for providers, and sometimes it's confusing, and some of them are older and may not be as relevant today. And so we are looking at the outcome standards that are important for providers to meet to assure that we're getting quality services and how we will monitor that to also assure that people are getting what they need. We have, as Lauren mentioned, a project to develop the rate setting methodologies. The equitable rates across the state is important, and it will also allow us to really be able to define what we expect to receive in a rate, and it will help with the communication with people who are receiving services and their providers around those services. We have been engaged for some time on a PCA reform to improve the integrity, to try to simplify the program, as well as to look at how to have it be more sustainable. And I believe we have an opportunity next week to come back and talk with you about PCA. These are all in combination with earlier efforts. Certainly consumer-directed options, how to help people make more decisions about their services when they choose to be able to hire the staff that are going to support them, is something that people want, and we've seen wonderful results, and we're continuing to focus on that. We also want to increase employment. It's important that people with disabilities know that employment is not just an option, but that are facilitated to help do that, to increase independence, to improve the quality of life, and also to help meet our business needs into the future. And lastly, many efforts to try to increase housing options so that people can live in homes of their choice, and does not necessarily mean living in your own house and isolated. Some people, just like all of us, might be a house, might be an apartment, might share a home with others, but to be able to really tailor services as cost effectively as possible while honoring the choices of what's important in their lives. So that's a brief summary of some of the programs we offer.
Oh. Thank you very much for your presentation. We have a question from Representative Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to see you in that seat there. It's a little more difficult than what it looks like when you're over here, I imagine. I'm sorry, I don't know the testifier's name, but I just have a couple of questions on the the waiver of services as it relates to people of color and immigrants. Part of what we hear here is that disproportionately people of color have these health disparities, that they fall into despair. And I just want to get a sense from you on how the department is doing with granting waivers and other long-term care with people of color.
Ms. Bartola.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, that's a good question. Again, we set up the policies. Often these are legislative around priorities, and then make the resources available to counties, because at a local level, they're the ones who are better able to look at what are the needs of their community and all of the different services that are available to try to manage that. We do have some information and data, and I can get back to you with some specifics of what we do know about the percentage of people who access services, and also some of the counties do identify gaps that they want to work on to try to improve that.
Madam Chair, so are there goals that are set with respect to making sure that as you establish the policies and deliver the resources, that counties and other direct service providers, are there standards or are goals that they have in order to make sure that they're capturing this population, or are we simply leaving it up to the local, the counties and the folks delivering the services to make that decision?
Ms. Bartola.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, the department as a whole has a goal around disparities. So we do look at data as a whole and try to evaluate all of our programs within that. Information is available to the counties. We don't pick particular goals, but that is an area that we are monitoring.
So you'll provide us, Madam Chair, so you'll provide us with that information. I mean, your answer is a little vague, and so I'm trying to get a little more specific to understand if what I sense is health disparities issues all across our disparities all across our system and our government, if we are focusing on that, and then with that being said, are we seeing the outcomes, or are we having a disparity about disparities, if you will? So I'm just trying to get a sense of that, and I don't know if you guys know that, and if you do, I'd love to see it.
Madam Chair and Representative, we will get you more information, and we'd be happy to have another conversation to follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Mack has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Bartolik, I just have a question with disability services specific to the issues of autism, a rising trend in the rates of that, especially in young people that will soon be, you know, entering the workforce possibly or becoming independent of parents. Do you know the waivered services, is that tend to fall into one particular waivered service? How does the department see that transpiring over time as this problem is becoming a bit greater across the state, and what tends to be the best fit for folks dealing with this, if there's a concrete answer at this point, or any thoughts you have on it would be good to hear.
Ms. Bartola.
Madam Chair and Representative, autism is a growing concern, and the department has many programs that can serve people with autism in a variety of different ways. So our children's mental health area and some of the rehabilitative services are good fits for some people. Our long-term care waivers, so the DD waiver and the CADDY waiver. The DD waiver is for people with developmental disabilities who would be at risk of an ICFMR. The CADDY waiver, the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, is an alternative for people who might be at risk of nursing home, but it's increasingly being used by people with mental illness. Both of those programs are programs that may fit. As you know, people with autism cover the spectrum. It's not a tidy package, and so our programs, we have many services that actually serve people. There is a statewide work group that includes people from the university, the Department of Health, DHS, and a number of others that are looking to try to understand the trends in autism, what people are using. So there will be more information available on that.
Thank you. Any follow-up? Okay. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I am one of the representatives from Ramsey County, and I live in Ramsey County. Two programs, the Ramsey County Nursing Home and Lake Owosso, you know, there are issues with stabilizing funding for those, and I think of all the different types of funding that are available. I mean, do you think that this legislature should be doing anything additionally so that we can make sure we have the most stable funding for places like the Ramsey County Nursing Home and Lake Owosso. Lake Owosso is an ICFMR.
Yeah. Ms. Bartol? Madam Chair and Representative, Lake Owosso is an ICFMR, so that does have funding. Because most of the ICFMRs over time converted over to home and community-based services, and we have a fairly limited number, there are some questions about what's the best way of supporting that over time. But that is a fairly stable source of funding. And I don't know that I'm going to be the best person to address your question on the nursing home, but perhaps Mr. Held, who will come in and address it after.
If he could, Madam Chair, if during his testimony, then those are just two, and they are kind of a little bit on the fringes, but something I know that long-term are issues for the county.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair, we'd be also happy to discuss that okay. further.
Thank you.
So Mr. Held is up next, so he'll answer that question and we'll get back to you. And Representative Fritz has a question for
you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is on the waivers. And I have, as most of us do have, and I'm sure all of us in our districts, I have parents who have children who need waivers. And I posed this before, but I want to bring it up again. I have people who have been waiting 5, 7, and 10 years to get on the waiver. And could you explain to us why that is, and what, if anything, we could do about that to initiate speeding that up for those folks?
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair and Representative Fritz, the home and community-based waivers do have limits. We have limits on the amount of money available and some limits on the number of people. When you have waivers such as the DD waiver that has had very limited new dollars added in every year, there are right now it's 6 new people a month that can be added into the program. It's very minimal. However, we do have some people who leave, and those dollars could be available. We also, one of the reasons we really want to look at different strategies for supporting people and seeing if there's more cost-effective ways of doing it, is it's a pot of money, a pool of dollars that a county has, and if there are some less expensive service models that can go into place, those dollars can be used to serve additional people. So some of the things, as I just mentioned, is how do we find different ways of supporting people that might not be as expensive? How do we assure that as people leave the program that we're able to make the best decisions? But otherwise, it is the limits on the waiver. We do have people who use these services for a lifetime. This is a birth-to-death service. People have a disability their entire life, and as families are no longer able to provide some of the support, it is important to look at how we are able to support people on an ongoing basis. And so there are more people coming to the system than we currently have resources to support. We try to help people find other resources. The we is a royal we, meaning the counties and everyone who's involved in the system. It might be that home care could help, some of these grant programs could help, but when people are looking at a program like the waiver that has a comprehensive set of services that can support them over time as they go through different transitions, there are limits on that, and we would have to expand that to some extent. In addition to trying to find other ways of using dollars more effectively.
Follow up.
When was the last time that we increased the waivers?
Madam Chair and Representative, every year there is some increase. There's some ability to add new people, but it's very limited. And what we could do is get you a chart that shows you how much new money went into the system every year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good information, Ms. Bartolik. I appreciate it. Always good to hear you. One of the things that I've questioned on, and I've gone through a few of these things, and that is on HCBS services seems to be something like a customized living. And by the way, I think my mother, when I grew up, would called it necessity is the mother of invention. So many times we do come up with creative ways of taking care of needs instead of having to fit people in a certain set thing or name of a program. Especially here, we have so many of them that we can often meet needs maybe in a little different way. So I appreciate your flexibility and your focus on the needs of our folks, even though it might be in a little different way. But could you explain a little bit more? And maybe there's a handout, but I was just kind of going through it. I couldn't find it as much, and that's the HCBS service, customized living, is what I was down here on the handout.
Okay.
Ms. Bartolet.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The customized living or assisted living, it's the same thing, is a service that's available through some of our waiver programs. It's primarily been used by people who are older who are on the elderly waiver as well as private pay. It's not available under the DD waiver, and it's been used to a more limited extent under the CADI waiver. So it's a service that is available that will allow people to receive services in the housing, and it actually is a category that has a lot of different looks. Some of them are very small, some of them you have your own apartment and just customized services, and some of them you have a base rate. And I think if you have specific questions, Jean Wood, who's our Director of Aging and Adult Services, is going to be able to address that a little bit more detailed.
I see. Thank you very much. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And another question from Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mrs. Chairman. And Mrs. Bartolet, is that correct?
Bartolet.
Just to clarify for me, I just was looking at the numbers under page one, just regarding the medical assistance care facilities. Is that the intermediate care facilities? Is that just the facilities? Can you explain that particularly? And then just in relation to the DT and H on the top of page two as well, if they are programs that are compound and work together to help those in need. Mm-hmm. And then just to follow up, is it also include some of the other programs that are working together to help those who are in need? That's all. Thank you.
Ms. Bartolet.
Madam Chair and Representative, the ICFMR is a facility. We have some that are small, and we have some that are larger. It's a particular federal certification that allows Medicaid dollars to support people. They do provide habilitative services, so they help people with developmental disabilities live and gain new skills and participate in their communities. So it's a facility-based service where you choose to move into this facility to get particular types of services. The waivers is an alternative to that. You don't have to go to a facility. You can get your services in a lot of different settings. So this is a limited number of facilities. There's a certain capacity in the system that right now we have 1,825 people living in those facilities. Now, the facilities are the overall what happens, but most people in an ICFMR, as well as many people who receive the DD waiver, can go to a day training and habilitation service. Often it's a facility, it's a building, it's a place you go, but not always. We also have providers who do this service in the community, and they'll be very flexible. But it's a service to, again, provide habilitation, help people gain new skills, be involved in their community, gain work experience, support them in employment. So it's a broad range of services. DT&H is a service that if you're in an ICFMR, many people go to a DT&H. If you're on a DD waiver, many people go there. But also many people who aren't on medical assistance funded services also go to a DT&H, and that's funded through the counties, often through property tax dollars and some other grant funding that comes to them. So the DT&H is a very broad service. It covers lots of different activities, and it's provided to many people both through county local funds as well as MA. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe it does. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're going to... Oh, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Bartolet, I appreciate that background. I think it's important for some of the newer members of the committee to understand, too. These were the people in the past who would have been institutionalized. And so we now have this array of services, and I'm personally very pleased to hear how much we're trying to move into the home setting and helping people both age in place as well as people with developmental disabilities to the extent possible, living healthy in their place, giving them more training where that's possible. But this is an array of services that we've developed as a much more positive alternative, frankly, to the institutionalized settings we experienced in the 60s and even early 70s. So that's a little bit of point of reference for the new members on the committee.
Thank you, Representative Gottwald. And thank you very much, Ms. Bartolik, for presenting today. I think we're going to move on to our next presenter, Mr. Held. Mr. Held, thank you, or welcome to our committee. Thank you so much for being here, and please identify yourself for.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I was asked to talk about a number of areas briefly, so I'm going to move very quickly through a lot of information, a lot of numbers. First question I was asked to address is what our division does. Nursing facility rates and policy. We set nursing facility payment rates, which is an annual event, but also occurs sporadically throughout the year. We have several strategies, recognizing that we're a purchaser. We are responsible for buying nursing home services for people who have medical assistance. And you'll hear some numbers lately that quantify that. But as a purchaser, we want to leverage that role to improve quality. Quality is often a concern with nursing home care, and so we have a number of strategies that we are pursuing to enable us to improve quality from that perspective. And finally, we seek to find ways as through nursing home policy to assist in rebalancing, to accomplish the type of thing with nursing facility residents that Representative Gottwald was just describing for the DD population. And you'll see that there's a continuous reduction in the utilization of nursing facilities, and partly we hope because of in response to the strategies that we've undertaken on that. The division employs 17 and a half full-time equivalents, and we do such things as gather, edit, audit, analyze statistical and cost information. We calculate payment rates. We prepare data for the nursing home report card. There's seven quality measures in the report card, and most of the data on that, some comes from the health department, most of it comes from our statistical and cost report. We pursue pay-for-performance strategies, part of that leveraging the purchasing role. We've done that through having quality add-ons, and we do it through a performance-based incentive payment program that we operate right now. We advise on policy, doing things like testifying at committees, providing technical assistance, reports, and so forth. And we operate a number of fairly limited policy type activities, such as planned closures, single bed incentive payments, issues around the moratorium for nursing homes, and so forth. A general description of the nursing home industry. There are 381 facilities that are in the medical assistance program. There are a small number of additional facilities, counting the veterans' homes, that are not in the medical assistance programs. But those 381 facilities currently have 32,342 beds. Minnesota has 51.1 beds per 1,000 elderly, age 65 and older. We used to be at 91. So we're looking better in terms of the perspective that we were a heavily overbedded state, but we're still about 20-25% higher than the national average. The utilization rate of people 65 and older of nursing home services is 4.0%. That means on any given day, 4% of the people 65 and older are in a nursing home. That was back in 1984 when we began to. This is as far back as we've analyzed this, that was 8.4%. So it's been cut to less than half of what it was. For the 85...
Excuse me, Mr. Held, we have a question. Oh, we want to wait. Okay, proceed.
For the 85-plus population, that's currently 15.1% utilization rate. That was 36.4 in 1984. So that also has been cut even a little bit more steeply. Median length of stay today is 27 and a half days. That was 41 days in 2002, so it's been steadily declining for many, many years, as has the mean. In our most recent year, we had 56,000 people admitted to nursing homes. That was, in 1989, that was 24,000 admissions. And so what you see is happening is that the nursing home role is changing. It's being used more as a Medicare short-stay rehab-type institution and less as a long-stay. The long-stay tends to be for people who have very complex needs or more advanced dementia. And finally, 37% of our beds, and I don't have this information nationally, but in Minnesota, 37% are in single-bed rooms. That's been going up steadily, too, for a number of years. And my impression is that that's, in comparison with other states, is very high. The Medicaid program in the last year spent $833 million on nursing facility care. The average month saw 19,000 recipients out of an average of out of 31,423 residents, and the nursing homes were running at 91.6% occupancy, which is quite low on a historical basis for Minnesota. A breakdown of ownership: 28% of Minnesota facilities are for-profit, 60% are not-for-profit, and 12% are non-state governmental-owned facilities, cities, counties, and hospital districts. How are days in nursing homes paid for? 57.8% by medical assistance, 8.7% Medicare, private pay is 25.5%, and other is 8%. Minnesota has a bed tax. We call it the surcharge. That's currently set at $2,815 per bed per year. It applies to all licensed nursing home beds. Most of them are in the Medicaid program, but those that are non-state owned nursing homes that are not in the Medicaid program also pay the surcharge. We reimburse nursing facilities an amount that is intended to approximate the cost of paying that tax, and that would be $8.86 per resident day. Boy, I feel like I'm just throwing a number at you. The surcharge results in $88 million of revenue to the state of Minnesota.
We do have one question. Representative Gottwald asked a couple of times.
It's kind of like
a break from the numbers.
Madam Chair, it's kind of like the seventh inning stretch.
Yes.
I appreciate the numbers, Mr. Hill. I had just one question. As you went through, you talked about the fact we've got about 25% more beds than other states on average. And the question I have of you is that helping set us up for the grain of Minnesota, the fact that our baby boomers are aging? Are we going to be glad we've got that surplus capacity? Or is that something because of how we're changing the use of nursing home beds for short-term stays rather than long-term? Is that going to be something we still have to decrease? Any thoughts on that, the capacity issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, predicting the future is always a bit hazardous. My personal opinion is that we're going to continue to see downsizing, at least for a number of years, that we're getting closer to the time where we're going to have access problems on at least localized basis. And the reason for that is the beds, you know, I'm telling you the number of beds per thousand for the state. Be grateful I didn't do that for each county. but that information is on our website, and so you can find that in the Status of Long-Term Care report. And what you'll see is that there's a huge disparity between counties and how many beds they have relative to the size of the elderly population. It goes from about 18 beds per thousand in the lowest bedded county up to about 118 or 117 in the most highly bedded county. Now, you'd expect some differences because in a rural area it might be, let's say, more challenging to provide services to people in their own homes. But I think it's because of that range that you see there that we're still overbedded in some areas, and in other areas we may find that the reverse is true.
Follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think what you see in the rural areas, if you look at the state demographer statistics, is Places like Hennepin County are going to remain, on average, much younger than some of these rural counties where you have smaller numbers of beds, but you will have an increasing percentage of the population much older. And so where you see the greatest demand is where we have the fewest beds is kind of the dynamic that seems to be playing out for greater Minnesota as opposed to perhaps the Twin Cities area.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could come back to your earlier question, I don't think I answered it completely, because you asked about the baby boom and are we going to wish we'd kept some of those beds. And our hope and intention through the plant closure program is to see closure of the beds that are in more overbedded areas, and preferably, and it hasn't always played out this way, but preferably beds that are a little more obsolete. And so we do see closures among facilities that are maybe financially stressed, partly because of low rates, but also because of low occupancy. They're in more competitive markets. And facilities often that need to either make some huge capital improvements to remain in compliance, say sprinkler systems, air handling, elevator replacement, or close and reposition themselves or simply go out of existence. And so my thinking as a baby boomer is that when the baby boomers start to need those nursing home beds in 15, 20, 25 years, I'd like something a little more contemporary than a facility that was built in the mid-60s.
Good point.
And from a cost perspective for the state, I think to continue to operate unneeded beds is going to be a lot more costly than to replace them when they're actually needed. And that's partly because the capital cost is a relatively minor part of what we pay. I have some figures that will get to that next.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Representative Huntley has a question.
Madam Chair and Mr. Held, if you could just expand what percentage, I'm interested in, a lot of the nursing homes are very old and have been around for 40, 50 years and are basically obsolete. Do you have any idea about the percentage of those that, I mean, I can tell you, nobody's building a new one with multiple bedrooms. Every new one is a single-room occupancy. Do you have any idea about how many of the beds should be replaced simply because of their age?
Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, we do have some data on the average age of facilities. And it's pretty advanced age. I don't have that with me. I don't believe we have any data that could give us a real precise picture about how many really need to be replaced right away. We haven't had funding for the moratorium process, which is the process through which facility replacements and upgrades, major capital improvements, can be made. When we most recently had funding for that, which was a couple years ago, we had, as I recall, $1.5 million a year to fund the state share of annualized costs of capital improvements, covering primarily interest payments. And at that time, we were looking at being able to replace the entire stock of nursing facilities. My recollection is it was approximately every 200 years. And so if we want to start getting at that issue of really replacing obsolete beds, we would be talking about huge appropriations. I'm thinking moratorium process in the $15, $20 million a year range. We've never done anything anywhere near that scope before.
Representative,
yeah, if I could just comment. One of the nursing homes in my area is probably 50 years old, and the cafeteria where people eat was designed for people that could walk from their rooms to the cafeteria area. And today they don't have a single patient or living there that can actually walk unassisted. So the nature that they're dealing with is completely different than what it was when the building was built.
And Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, what we're also seeing is that the design features today are much, much different than they were 50 years ago. You know, we used to build facilities with long halls with rooms on both sides of the hall and a dining room on a lower floor, maybe rehab in a teeny little closet. And what we're seeing now are our neighborhood approaches where within a unit that might consist of 12, 10 to 15, maybe 17 people, you've got some food prep area, you've got a dining area for that group of people. It'd be mostly or all single bedrooms, like you indicated earlier. And so what we're seeing is the model of care that's really going to be the standard that people will expect and look for is changing a lot.
Thank you. Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hill, thank you for the numbers. I think it would be helpful if we had a hard copy of those numbers with the trend line. You mentioned one or two trend lines here, and I'd really like to see a picture of what's been happening. And one of the trend line questions I have is you mentioned that currently about 25% are private pay residents. What's been the trend line there? Is that about what it's been for some time, or is it a higher percentage or not? And I'm particularly interested in asking you what effect there has been with efforts that we've undertaken in the legislature to keep people from unloading their assets so that the state could pick up the costs of their being in a nursing home. We've done some good things over time to try and keep that from happening. Has it worked?
Mr. Held, can you hold your answer for just a quick second? I just wanted to announce to everyone that we're going to hold off on item number 4 and number 5 until another time because there's so much interest in this part of the discussion, so we're just going to move those off to another day. But they will be back, so Mr. Held, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I want to thank items 4 and 5 for giving me more time. And Representative, is it
Lanning?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the distribution of payer source has shifted over time, and the biggest two items that have changed, well, the items that have changed the most are those other than private pay. Private pay, which is what I would have expected, frankly, to have seen it gone way down because of all the assisted living that's become available. It used to, the highest I recall it ever being was about 27.5%. It's 25.5% right now. Medicaid also has gone down. Used to, the highest I recall it being is about 63, maybe 65%. It's now 58. Medicare is up. That has gone up a few points. And the biggest growth proportionately has been other. And that's a little bit unfortunate, and we've tried to get into more detail on that, but we weren't able to do that without creating a huge burden on the facilities reporting that data to us, and we were reluctant to do that. Other consists of long-term care insurance. Mm-hmm. It consists of just some other payer source. But the biggest piece of other, we believe, is health plans, primarily Medicaid and Medicare, MSHO, health plan. And the facilities really had a hard time. For one year, a couple years ago, we required them to report that, and they basically couldn't do it. It was a bit of a fiasco, and they begged us to stop requiring that data, and we deferred to that. But that's been the biggest grower. And a lot of those MSHO days will be Medicare days. So when I say Medicare is 8.7, it's probably in excess of 10 when you include the portion of other that's really coming from Medicare. In terms of divestiture, my division does not handle eligibility issues. I know that in audits we have recently discovered at least a small trend of people who have bought long-term care insurance and have been, their family's been pocketing the proceeds and putting the person on Medicaid, and we've been able to recover some funds because of that discovery. But I don't have data, and I can see if I can find out what would be known about divestiture and whether or not that's been addressed. I know that a few years ago the look-back period was increased from 3 years to 5.
Well, Madam Chair, I would be very much interested in finding out more about what's been happening here since we've enacted policy to try and keep people from unloading their assets so that the taxpayers would pick up the costs here, and if we're making progress on that or not, mm-hmm. I think is an important question. Thank you.
I think you're right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Oh, just to that point, some of these, we tried to decide how much to pack into one of these meetings, and I don't know if you've mentioned it, but we're going to spend the rest of the meeting on this topic, and we're going to forego, you know, just that. Okay, but on these questions about all this estate planning is really complicated, and if some small group of members want to sit down, we can, the staff would, from the department and whoever would come and spend, you know, an hour or whatever. So we can, just if you talk to Christine, she can coordinate that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have a few more questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Held. This is really interesting, and I...
I couldn't tell who was talking.
Yeah, I know. That's a hazard of these rooms sometimes. I also was really interested in the numbers. I was trying to write them down, and I thought I heard you say they're on the website, but it would be really helpful to have some kind of a fact sheet on that, so I echo Representative Lanning on that. Well, there are a lot of things I would like to ask you about, and this is a really big topic and one that obviously has a lot of impact on our budget and is really a serious topic for this committee. So I don't necessarily know if you're going to have time to really respond to all these things right now, but I would like to have you give this committee a little bit of a primer on the rate differentials, the geographic differences in rates, and you know, I know that's going to be of interest to people. It's certainly for those of us from outstate where the rates are lower, it's of interest always. And but the other thing, and I don't know if that's appropriate for today or not, but I think you're the guy to do that, though. But then the one question that I hope you could answer now, but again, if you're not the right person, that's fine. But I'm kind of curious about how are the benefits we give for long-term care on our public programs, how that compares to other states, and kind of the, you know, the issue that people often talk about with MA or with our welfare, quote-unquote, is people sometimes say that we're attracting people to Minnesota because of our, quote-unquote, generous benefits. And in the past when we've had hearings on this, usually when people say that, they mean... Well, they're thinking of poor mothers and kids or something like that. And I think that we've had hearings that kind of shows that not to be borne out by the data. But I'm wondering in the area of long-term care whether there's any sort of trend that Minnesota is actually attracting people to move to the state because they're elderly and they want to be either for services that may be better here or... for any other reason. And you know, and I ask this, I'm not sort of making this up out of whole cloth, but I'm from Rochester. Obviously we have very, very good medical services in Rochester, and I do frequently speak to people who've actually moved to Minnesota because they want to be near the Mayo Clinic, which is a great thing, and it's, you know, it's great for our community. But on the other hand, you know, I want to know if this then impacts our you know, there's no financial test at the border for whether the people then that move here for whatever reason are going to need help from Minnesota at some point. So I wonder if you can give us any sense of trends in that regard.
Mr. Hill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think it would be interesting to look at the issue of how Minnesota's benefits compare with other states. I don't know a lot about that, but I do know that nursing home is an essential, it's a mandatory Medicaid service. And so the differences would be among the optional services. And I'm thinking that Gene Wood, who will be talking next, may know a little bit about that. and Alex may also, or Lauren, but that's also something we could see what we can put together on that for you. In terms of nursing home services, we generally attract people from out of state in places like Moorhead, where it's right next to Fargo. I mean, it's basically one metropolitan area, so there may be family reasons, and we have a reciprocity agreement with North Dakota. I am not aware of people coming to Minnesota just because we have such terrific nursing homes. I think there may be a couple facilities that provide very specialized care that are an exception to that. In terms of, the example, I'm not sure I should name names, but the example that comes to mind is Courage Center. And I think, and I saw John Chita here a moment ago, he may be able to tell you if what their out-of-state issues are. You also asked about geographic differences or disparities, and we recently produced a report to the legislature, I think it was about a year ago that we completed this, on rate disparities in nursing homes. And so it's interesting you should ask that question. I don't have an ability to put this on an overhead for you, but this is available online on the DHS website, and we can certainly send a link to that. But you can see this little table here, which has a couple lines on a line graph. And the red or pink line is, that we have three geographic groups. Historically, we divided the state into three groups based on what we call geographic groups, and it was a group three was metro, group two was rural, and group one was deep rural. And this is a chart that shows for group two in the pink line, what are their average rates as a percentage of the average rate in the metro group. And it's going from 1999 through 2009 here. And so you can see it went from 84% back at the beginning of that time frame and did show some improvement over the first few years and then pretty much stabilized. And that's because the legislature enacted some provisions to provide increases that were either available only to low-rate facilities or were bigger for low-rate facilities.
Excuse me, Mr. Held, Representative or Chairman.
Thanks, Blair. And Representative Liebling and Mr. Held, there's going to be a bill coming up which references this question, so that'd probably be a good time to have these charts printed out. And it's a really good discussion to have, so we'll discuss that when that bill comes up.
Okay. And then I think I was just told not to continue down that track.
Representative Liebling.
Right, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Held. Yeah, I wasn't, that's why I sort of prefaced by saying I wasn't sure that today would be the day because I think this is a really big topic, but I just sort of wanted to flag for the committee that, that this is, well, most people probably know that this is a big issue. There's usually rate differentials is one of those things that splits us not so much along partisan lines but along geographic lines in the legislature, and there are lots of issues that do that. But, I just kind of wanted to make note of that, and I hope that on another day, I think the chairman is saying that we need to do a lot more on this and have all the things in front of us so that we can all really understand why the differences and what they are. So thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I had, in trying to design my 7 minutes for today, I had thought about getting into the history of nursing home rate setting and how it resulted in today's picture. Mm-hmm. And so I think given what I've just heard, for today's purpose, I would just simply say it really is a broken system. I mean, this is the guy that administers it, and I'm acknowledging it's a broken system. And we've been struggling for as long as I can remember, and certainly as long as I've been in this job, to try to bring some order and some rationality and to align it with what we believe are the state's policy goals. And clearly, reducing rate disparities is a strong interest by a lot of people in the industry and in the legislature. And the bottom line is you could do it for free, but it would be redistributive, and about half of the facilities would be at your doorstep.
Thank you for your honesty. We have a couple more questions. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just wanted to just make a comment before my question. When I was on the hospital board, we put on an assisted living facility to serve our local residents, our seniors. But when we opened up for people to start making reservations, we found out they were coming from all kinds of other states. And we were puzzled by that. And what we found the dynamic was many times is that the seniors move to be close to their children. And we all think that because the children often have jobs or other things, so they aren't going to be able to move. So it's a dynamic that they are going to come from other states, and your area in Rochester is an excellent choice. But the dynamic that really drove them more than anything is, where are their kids? And that they move to be close to them. And I think that's a valid decision and another dynamic that can contribute to that. And nonetheless, with the broken system as far as the whole thing, nursing homes aren't what they used to be anymore. But the comment that you made before on this whole surcharge to nursing homes really bothers me. And so the $2,815 and a total of $88 million per year, when did that start? Is it the same amount as it started? And what was the original, I know you have a lot of history, so I can ask this of you, some history of why would we ever surcharge a nursing home for money to come to the state to go into, I think, the general fund?
Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, now I'm going to go by memory, but the surcharge, I recall, began in about 1993. And I believe it was $620 per bed per year at that time. Shortly after that, it went up to $625, and it stayed there for a long time. In 2002, it was increased to $990, which was an increase of a dollar a day. It was from $625. In 2003, it was increased by $1,825, bringing it to $2,815. I can't believe I'm coming up with these numbers.
Be sharp.
It has not increased since then. Why would the state do this? That's a really fascinating question. On the one hand, you could look at it. Well, I'm going to try to do this without getting clever. When the state pays facilities a portion of their rate to cover the cost of the surcharge. So the bottom line is, for every bed that's licensed in the state takes in $2,815 per year. We pay money back, so money's coming in, going out. Why are we doing that?
Yeah.
Well, the money that we use to pay that rate is for 57.8% of days. The rest of the days are Medicare or private pay or other. And we don't pay anything for the when they pay that money, and we're not paying them anything for that. So that's all money that goes to the bottom line of the general fund. The ones that are on MA, so it's almost two-thirds of that population, half of the money that we spend for that rate portion is federal dollars. That's the reason why states do this. And roughly 35 states have surcharges. So we pay out something like $25 million a year in that rate component, and we take in the $88 million $88 million a year in exchange. So there's a net benefit of $63 million, and that's the reason why the state does it.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Slawik, did he answer your question from before, or did you want to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I saw the Ramsey County slide up there, so I thought we were talking about Ramsey County, but I think that's going to be next time. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's the next testifier then. Okay. Very good. Well,
Okay,
Mr. Held.
I'll continue. I just have a very little bit left, and what I wanted to talk about is the average nursing home per diem payment rate, $165.14, and that breaks down into three components: operating, a component that we call external fixed, which is things like the surcharge portion of the rate, and property. 80% is operating, and then each of the others are 9 or 10%. A question came up recently, so I thought I'd throw it in here. What portion of the money that nursing homes spend is for their staff? 76% is for wages, taxes, and benefits of their staff. And the final thing I want to highlight is the nursing home report card, which I touched on earlier as one of the things that we do in my division. You can find it in the Minnesota Department of Health website. It currently receives 2,000 or more visitors every month, unique visitors. It shows data on 7 quality measures: clinical quality of care, and by the way, we've seen improvement over the life of that measure in 17 out of the 24 measures. Quality of life, an interview with residents to ask them about their perspective on living in the nursing home. We've seen improvement in all 13 domains over the 4, 5, 6 years that we've been gathering that data. We include findings from the Minnesota Department of Health inspection, the certification review process. We look at how much direct staffing there is. We gather data on staff retention, how many people that are working there were there a full year. And by the way, 75% of the direct care workers have been there for a full year or longer, and that's a measure that has been going up slightly over the several years that we've collected that data, especially in the last year or so, probably because of the economy. And finally, we look at how much of the staff consists of staff from temporary agencies or nursing pools. 68% of nursing homes in Minnesota do not use nursing pools at all in the most recent reporting year. And of those that do, only 1.75% of their staff comes from pools. And the 7th measure is the percentage of beds in single bedrooms. I already noted that was 37%. So, Madam Chair, if there's any questions.
Okay, well, I think right now I'm being instructed we need to hold these because we have 2 more. Or where are you going to?
First statement.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Gottwald.
I think at some point it would be good, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, to have some of Mr. Held's, the benefit of some of Mr. Held's vision for what he sees needs to be done to prepare ourselves for the future, the needs of the future. What do the facilities need to look like? We haven't talked at all about hospice, but that's going to become a bigger issue as well. And how much of this we need to shift to home-based services versus, it'd be really interesting to see a vision for the future.
Madam Chair. Sounds like a good topic for the Reform Committee.
Okay, get right on that. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Held, for your testimony. Good job. And next we have Jean Wood from Aging and Adult Services Director.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you for coming to our committee, Ms. Wood. We're going to have to ask you to keep your remarks to about 7 minutes, if that's possible. I'm very sorry, because we have one more testifier after you.
Okay. Good afternoon, and I will try and keep to 7 minutes.
And please identify yourself.
Okay. I'm Jean Wood, and I'm the Director of Aging and Adult Services at the Department of Human Services. And in that role, I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. Aging and Adult Services Division funds, oversees, sets policies, sets rates, and provides services through the Elderly Waiver and the Alternative Care Programs, through the Older Americans Act, which we administer with the Minnesota Board on Aging. We also develop sustainable home and community-based services.
Excuse me, could you pull the mic a little bit closer to yourself? Thank you.
I'm not that tall.
Sorry. We want to make sure everyone can hear every word you say. Thank you.
And we are also the home of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care and the State Office of Adult Protective Services. We administer multiple grant programs with 250 nonprofit and governmental grantees. We work with lead agencies, including counties, tribes, and managed care organizations or health plans, along with area agencies on aging and numerous stakeholders. All of these functions are coordinated at the local level and seek to maintain older people in their homes for as long as we can and to keep them out of more expensive care such as nursing homes. The division has 60 FTEs who provide direct services, train and educate community partners, monitor grantee progress, provide technical assistance in areas of best practice, such as falls prevention, caregiver support, and, of course, produce required reports. Our administrative funding is 55% state, 45% federal. I am going to be, I assume you have, this is open as your document, the summary of long-term care programs and services. I think you've been following along with that. And so I'm now on page 5, where it talks about the elderly waiver and alternative care programs who meet, these are for persons who meet a certain financial eligibility, and they frequently need more intensive long-term care services due to increased frailty. Elderly waiver is medical assistance, and the alternative care program is state funds only. Elderly waiver, again, frequently receive more intense services. They may be getting home health, meals, housekeeping, chore, a package of services, but they also could be living in customized living setting, better known as an assisted living. Currently, 35% of elderly waiver recipients are in assisted living. When it comes to providing those services, 93% of all seniors served under elderly waiver are receiving their services through a managed care organization. The remaining 7% of people on elderly waiver and those on alternative care are served through counties. The average age of someone on elderly waiver or alternative care is 82. On the next two pages of the handout, you will see in white a list of the state funding, which is provided for the maintenance and development of home and community-based services that help communities have sufficient services to serve and maintain seniors in their own home. Much of this funding was dedicated to development based on recommendations of the 2001 Long-Term Care Task Force, made up of legislators and executive branch representatives. The remainder of the funds then listed in white are state funds used to work with and to match the federal funds, which I will be getting into shortly. And again, all of these help to fund home and community-based services for older individuals in communities. Since the time of the task force, we have steadily decreased the proportion of persons being served in nursing homes and have increased the proportion of persons served through home and community-based services. Shaded in red are the federal Older Americans Act funds, and again, they are administered with the Minnesota Board on Aging and its 7 area agencies on aging. The board is a 25-member governor-appointed board, administratively placed at the Department of Human Services. And through the Older Americans Act, the area agencies fund, again, local nonprofit organizations who use volunteers in many aspects of service delivery. Typically, persons served under the Older Americans Act receive 1 to 3 services, such as transportation, home-delivered meals, or chore services, so they can remain at their home. A typical person served under the Older Americans Act is 78 years old, a woman, and living alone. The most used service under the Older Americans Act is the Senior Linkage Line, where many seniors turn in order to choose an appropriate Medicare Part D plan, a supplemental health plan, or to learn about their long-term care options. Turning to the middle of page 8, still shaded in the red, you will see that there are some competitive federal grants that we receive either through the Older Americans Act or through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in order to implement new practices that have been tested and found to be effective. And you'll see that there's a series there that are dedicated to changing practices with caregivers of individuals with Alzheimer's and also the early identification and treatment of Alzheimer's, just to point to some of those new practices. And then the final grant on that page is a special revenue grant that's used to support resident and family councils in nursing homes and give nursing home residents a way to participate in the day-to-day life in the nursing home. And so with that, I can take questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks for keeping on that time schedule. Really appreciate that. Any questions for Ms. Wood? I'm sorry, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the points of discussion that we had last session was the amount of assisted living beds that we have per capita in comparison to other states in the nation. What do you think contributes to that?
Ms. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh. You know, we have a history of also having been overbedded in nursing homes, and so we seem to, I think when we find a model to build it, I'm sure that there are probably many causation factors and many contributing factors to the building of assisted living beds, but you know, we can look into that a little bit further, but I'm not too sure there is just one.
And just one last question. That's something that's interesting. I really like to look at to more. And I know some of the reports that were out last year. I want to add clarity is that there was some problems with the methodology. So they were they did show a higher concentration than what the reality is. But one of the things that Mr. Held gave was the percentage of nursing homes that were for profit and non profit. What is that in the assisted living community?
Ms. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, assisted livings are registered as housing with services with the Department of Health, and I will have to see if they collect that kind of information. When it comes to paying for people in assisted living, we're only 8 to 10% of the business of people in assisted living, and so they are many of them are filled with private pay individuals, and we do not necessarily have information about them or their facilities.
Thank you. The health department will be in tomorrow, and I guess you can ask that question tomorrow, too, and they'll probably be able to answer it, I'm told. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then Mr. Hodek.
Madam Chair. While he's coming down, Representative Murphy wants to introduce two new staff people to us.
Thank you, Representative Abler and Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to introduce to everybody Luke Kuhl. And Luke comes to Health and Human Services from House Research, from Partisan Research, where he's worked for a number of years. And he's new to Health and Human Services and has been asking for acronym lists that we can quiz him on. So if you have a tricky acronym that you think you could stump him with, you should give it to him and he'll figure out the answer. And then I'd also like to introduce behind me Dan Pollack, who has left the House of Representatives and gone to the Department of Human Services as the legislative liaison for Commissioner Jessen and the team over there. And so I thought it would be important for everybody to know where everybody's sitting and who's doing what.
Thank you for doing that. Thank you. Mr. Hodek, thank you for coming to our committee today. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, good afternoon. My name is Bruce Hodek. I'm the Division Director for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. First, I'd like to give you an overview about our program and finish with an information about the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I know we have a time limit, so I probably have about 5 minutes. And I'm going to do my best to speed sign. As Lauren Coleman mentioned in his opening remarks, continuing care does provide service to a variety of individuals. The same applies to deaf people. Our focus is to assist people whose ability to succeed, control their own lives, and live independently is compromised because of their language and communication barriers that they experience. On page 9 of your handout, near the bottom, you will notice that we have 7 regional offices. We do not have age restrictions for our services, and we work with individuals in all aspects of their lives, in healthcare, employment, housing, emergency preparedness, corrections, law enforcement, and education. We do provide a wide array of services. For example, we work with adults who use American Sign Language and secure interpreting services in a variety of settings, including healthcare. We work with seniors who are hard of hearing to assess their home environment and determine their needs for assistive devices. And that would enable those individuals to stay in their home longer. We work with families who have recently identified their child with a hearing loss, and we discuss approaches how to communicate with the family members and integrate that child into the family. We also provide direct mental health services to deaf individuals who use American Sign Language. Also on page 9, it also shows a few key data about the people we served. In fiscal year 10, our regional offices served 8,600 people and agencies to help resolve communication barriers. Our mental health program provided therapy and support as well as case management to 100 individuals. The telephone equipment distribution program served 4,400 people with a hearing loss or a speech or physical disability that would prevent those individuals from using traditional telephone services. We have trained nearly 12,000 people about the impacts of hearing loss and about communication access. Moving on to page 10, $1.7 million in grants address the gaps in traditional services provided and augment the services that our regional offices provide. We do provide equipment to individuals and assess those individuals that have very complex needs. This includes intervention, providing sign language interpreters to individuals who use American Sign Language. We work with deaf-blind individuals. We work with individuals who are deaf as well as having a severe mental illness. We work with children who have hearing loss and have an emotional or behavioral disorder. We work with sign language mentors to work with families with children who are deaf to develop their sign language skills to communicate with their family. Lastly, in our items, we talk about our grants. This is a grant for TV captioning for Greater Minnesota who are not obligated by law to provide this service. But this does provide critical access to these individuals in those communities and a resource for them to stay abreast in their community issues. Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services has 47 FTEs, and all of our staff are fluent in American Sign Language and have the expertise and social and emotional ramifications of a hearing loss. 85% of those staff are involved with direct service, and about 3/4 of those positions are funded through the general fund, and the remaining positions are funded through special revenues. In contrast, the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans serves a different function. They do have a 15-member governor-appointed volunteer commission whose primary priority is to advocate for all Minnesotans who are suffering from a hearing loss to have equal access. The department does provide support to the commission, and that commission does have 3.5 FTEs, and they're funded through special revenues. Mary Hartnett is the executive director, and she is in the audience today. I would like to wrap up today Just with a few challenges that we are experiencing in our regional offices. One, again, is the age wave of the baby boomers. One out of three people over the age of 65 do have a significant hearing loss. Secondly, we do have a lot of experience with our returning veterans. Returning home from war are experiencing a hearing loss. Lastly is really prevention. We would like to focus more of our efforts on public information about the need to protect your hearing. Whether you're using an iPod, maybe a chainsaw, mowing the grass, really your hearing is very important and precious to all of us. So that's the short and sweet 5 minutes of speed signing of our services. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hodak. That was a great presentation. Are there any questions from any of the members? Well, seeing no questions, thank you all to all of the presenters. You all did a great job. It was a very good day. Thank you, and the meeting is adjourned.